Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Bernie Siegel. He's the executive director of the Genetics Policy Institute. Welcome, Bernie.
Welcome. Thank you.
We just met at a designer baby policy meeting, which was very exciting for me. And I think you said I was the first card-carrying transhumanist you'd met.
That's absolutely right.
Well, that's good. Well, I was very excited to learn about the work of your group, which I had read about in the media, but to meet you in person was much more informative. And I wanted to share with our audience about the history of the group, which has been very instructive. So tell us how you first went from being an attorney with no particular interest or expertise in genetics and health policy to getting involved in this field.
Well, it's a little unusual. What happened is that there was a announcement, you might remember, about 2 years ago by the a company called Clonaid, or a so-called company called Clonaid, that they had cloned the first human being. They made this announcement from a Holiday Inn in Broward County, Florida. I was a practicing attorney some 30 years in Miami. The first 10 years, I was very involved in child advocacy work, helping parents in parental kidnapping cases and such. And it occurred to me that this group had made this announcement. No one was really trying to investigate the claim in a realistic way. I'd helped my daughter with a paper on Dolly the sheep when she was in high school and realized that no one could really clone a human being successfully with the technology at hand. And I decided to make a footnote in a law journal, maybe, that as the first case to protect the rights of a cloned human being. So I filed a petition to get a temporary guardian appointed. That set off a seismic blast, as it turns out, and a media firestorm as the group used my case as a pretext not to do the DNA test they promised the world. In the 30 days of that the case was going on, and eventually ended when this Dr. Bridget Beausoleil of the Raelian movement and testified in court that there was a clone child, and the child was in Israel, so Florida didn't have any jurisdiction. I was really appalled that this group was impacting the public policy debate on something called therapeutic cloning, a form of stem cell, embryonic stem cell research. And I had reached out to legitimate scientists as I was under great media scrutiny myself. And when the case was over, people like Ian Wilmot and Professor Rudolf Janisch at MIT encouraged me to create an organization to sort of serve as a mouthpiece for legitimate science against the charlatans. And along the way, I connected dots with folks in biotech and patient advocates, and we created the Genetics Policy Institute.
So your motivation was really the defense of science, which I think many people pegged your motivation at the time with that you're coming out of the Christian right or some sector of conservative politics trying to demonize all cloning, but actually you were trying to defend embryonic stem cell research.
Well, as it turns out, I was against, on safety reasons, reproductive cloning. I didn't want to see that in reproductive cloning, or the foes of, just because you're a foe of reproductive cloning, there were folks that were trying to politicize and kind of blur the issue, because there is a great difference between therapeutic cloning, what the scientists call nuclear transfer, and reproductive cloning. And it was that realization that I realized that there was a niche to be filled in the public policy debate. And along the way, of course, I've learned much more about the politics of the situation and been very much involved in the public policy debate.
Well, let's talk for a second about the technologies and why people make this this confusion, because there is, in fact, a nuclear transfer involved in embryonic stem cell research, where you take the nucleus of one cell out and put it in another. And why do people do that nuclear transfer?
Well, nuclear transfer would be a way to get genetically matched material. And arguably, the research shows that you would be able to transform one of your, for example, one of your 100 trillion somatic cells, your body cells, could be put into an unfertilized egg and with the DNA removed. And you could reprogram your own cell into an embryonic stem cell, and that could create any type of tissue in your own body, and possibly be able to use as a, create a stem cell line from that, and to create and repair damaged tissues that would be genetically matched to your own body. So it's a medical breakthrough, if not a revolution. And this therapeutic cloning nuclear transfer technique is one of two sources of stem cells. Embryonic stem cells, one being the leftover or to be discarded embryos from in vitro fertilization procedures that are frozen, but this is another source of those cells. And the foes of embryonic stem cell research, of course, want to blur this and say that this will lead down the slippery slope to reproductive cloning. These issues need to be detached.
Well, the argument that they use is that if we were able to perfect the nuclear transfer and the creation of viable stem cell lines out of embryos that had your DNA, and we could make stem cell lines that were useful for therapeutic purposes, that same technology, the perfecting of that technology, would also be necessary for perfecting reproductive cloning. So that this line of research would lead eventually to reproductive cloning.
Well, that's their argument. And in a society, if they wanted to draw a line, I would submit that the line could be drawn at the implantation of a cloned embryo into a woman's uterus. And that's the question: where do you draw the lines? If you are a parent with a child with diabetes, or a friend of someone who has a severe spinal cord injury, I would prefer to listen to the scientist in this case, or the American Medical Association, rather than the so-called bio-Luddites or social conservatives that would try to restrict this research. I think that would be a very serious thing to do, and this research shouldn't be impeded.
Now, do you personally, or does the GPI, the Genetics Policy Institute, institutionally have a policy about what the appropriate safeguards on the embryo should be? Because there is concern in many quarters that as we are increasingly able to produce embryos and make them increasingly complicated in the laboratory, that there should be some line beyond which you have to say you can't do any more research beyond this degree of development.
Well, I have approached this by recruiting a really prominent science advisory board. And in talking to the scientists, most of them say that these embryos should not be extended past the 14th day, that, you know, there's the primitive streak, the beginnings of a spinal cord, and for other reasons the cells would not be useful after that time, because there's going to be a differentiation in the cells. So at this point, I will follow what the scientists tell me as far as the limitations.
So for embryonic stem cell research purposes, you wouldn't need anything beyond the 14th day of differentiation, and also for a lot of other kinds of genetics research purposes.
That's right.
Yeah. But there are a lot of different kinds of embryologic and fetal research that we might do, like fetal surgery and things like that, in which case it might be useful to have something beyond that, but you don't have, your organization isn't focused on that.
That's right. We don't have a policy stand.
Right. Now, you ended up at the UN because, tell us how you got to the UN, and then tell us what happened at the UN.
Well, this was interesting. As I was following the policy debate, it occurred to me, of course, that there really was the need to detach these two issues, reproductive and therapeutic cloning. And the UN was studying the matter in its legal committee. And it was considered about 2 years ago that there was going to be a stalemate. There were two competing treaties. One called for a total ban of both reproductive and therapeutic cloning, and the other said reproductive cloning should be banned, but each member state should have its own views and regulations of therapeutic cloning and embryonic research, cell research. So it occurred to me in researching the law that there was quite a body of international law that was condemning reproductive cloning. And the line could be drawn there. And in fact, in a stalemated UN, that the World Court, the International Court of Justice, could render an advisory opinion that would say reproductive cloning violates international law based on the existing pronouncement of international law. So I was suggesting that be done, detaching the two issues, and thereby avoid a treaty that could ban everything. I was much to my surprise, in November 2003, I found out that the social conservative forces in the United Nations were pushing, even if by a single vote, a worldwide treaty for a total ban, which was unacceptable, especially to the patient advocate groups who want research to advance. So my organization led a grassroots effort, successfully, I might add, and the decision in the UN was postponed for a year. And now we've been in the UN again, and it looks like we've been able to push back so there won't be a treaty for a total ban, that the UN will come up with some declaration that no matter what it says, it's not going to impede stem cell research.
So the great irony is that just as in the U.S. Congress, the social conservatives continue to be the principal obstacle to an international treaty to ban reproductive cloning, which 99% of the world thinks is a good idea. Not me, but 99% of the world thinks it's a good idea. And yet the social conservatives are holding it up.
Well, it is one of those great ironies. I think of, unfortunately, this issue is sort of being held hostage in the debate over Roe v. Wade and abortion politics. That's the reality of the situation.
So who's the Bush administration's principal allies in this social conservative wing of the UN?
Well, the treaty was proposed by Costa Rica, and there are about 60 co-sponsors for this, including Italy and many of the smaller countries in Micronesia, the Caribbean, in Africa. But the larger countries, and especially the countries that support biomedical technologies, are all in favor of the Belgian proposal, which again would ban reproductive cloning and allow each country to chart its own course on therapeutic cloning.
So those, the larger countries would be places like China and India, representing almost half the world's population, and they both have embryonic stem cell research going on in
exactly.
their countries.
Exactly. In fact, in this particular journey that I've been on, I gave up the practice of law to do this project full time. I've been to South Korea and seen some of their stem cell research laboratories, which are absolutely incredible. And, you know, I like to say I've seen the future. The future is in Asia, at least in this.
Now, South Korea has also moved ahead on the first steps towards reproductive cloning. They made some announcements recently. And so how do you feel about that?
Well, I think the South Korean scientists have really advanced stem cell research with the work they're doing. My organization staged a science conference in June for the United Nations in UN headquarters, where I brought in scientists from around the world on the issue on the difference between reproductive and therapeutic cloning, hopefully wanting to teach the UN delegates the difference. And I brought in Dr. Moon and Dr. Wang, the two scientists that had created the first therapeutically cloned stem cell line. And their techniques were brilliant. This is pathfinding work. And it showed that this could be done. So there was more to this than just some esoteric scientific debate, that this is all reality-based. So I think what the work that they are doing is remarkable.
I'm speaking with Bernie Siegel. He's the director of the Genetics Policy Institute in Coral Gables, Florida. As we commented, now you can have a Policy Institute just about anywhere because of the internet. And he got involved in genetics policy and stem cell policy and cloning policy a couple years ago with the Raelian cult intervention that he made. And let's talk a little bit about the future of politics around these issues in the United States, because we've just had this cataclysmic creation of a fund for the support of embryonic stem cell research in California. Now, many other states are rushing to catch up. And this has really slapped the Bush administration in the face, that there is that all the blue states are ready to go ahead with embryonic stem cell cloning. Do you think that we are in the safe, or is there still movement in the United States to shut down this research?
There's a very strong movement in the United States to shut down the research. Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas has proposed the Brownback bill that could really set this back if passed in law, which would criminalize therapeutic cloning. Not only that, it could throw doctors in jail for 10 years, researchers in jail, fine them millions of dollars, and even if a patient went abroad to get some cloned stem cells to repair their damaged heart, they could be imprisoned as well. So this draconian legislation is out there ostensibly to stop human cloning, but it really is to try to shut down a critically needed form of embryonic stem cell research. And, of course, if this federal law came into play, it could threaten the different state initiatives.
I'm sure that you're aware that there's been a really bizarre convergence of people from the left with the social conservatives, people like Jeremy Rifkin, who helped organize a left-wing petition in support of the Brownback bill about 2 years ago, where he suckered a lot of left-wingers into who were pro-choice and all kinds of things into supporting the Brownback bill on the grounds that it was a bill to prevent cloning, which everyone is against for one reason or another. And I just wondered if you could comment on how you see this left-right harmonic convergence of bioluddites taking place and where it's going to lead us.
Well, you know, I like to call that the unholy alliance. It's very strange in a way that this umbrella groups, tying in all sorts of folks that you wouldn't think would get together, far-left feminist with environmental extreme environmentalist and of course the right to life movement. I think it's problematic, but it's out there. I think the counterforce is a potential tidal wave, though. I think what we are finding are patient groups and ordinary citizens, when they realize that everyone's health is at risk, is a tremendous force. When you're opposed to folks who want to ban something, it's like the worst kind of prohibition. I read somewhere, it might have been in Reason or somewhere, that if you have a child with critically ill with diabetes, all the hand wringing of the bioethicists and all the pieties of the preachers aren't going to make too much of a difference. You'll want to seek that cure. And I think by that, you look at what happened in California. It was a tidal wave. And it's not to say that these folks don't have some concerns that need to be addressed, maybe some social justice concerns or other things. But these things are going to be just washed away because people want, this is an emergency. Millions of people are suffering in the world. And we're at this little point of time where you have the ability, a scientific revolution, a potential breakthrough of regenerative medicine. So you don't have surgery or drugs, but you're actually able to repair and replace tissues. We have that at the same time of the internet and the information age, this amazing convergence, and we are going to see a tidal wave of support for these technologies.
Well, let's talk about the social justice issues for a second, because it would seem that is an important set of issues to address. We want there to be universal access to health care, and one of the things that many of the left bioluddites argue is that increasing attention to these high-tech health technologies will distract attention from the need for more basic health technologies. And I wonder, you said you've seen in South Korea, South Korea's a developing country, and Cuba has an advanced genetics policy, genetics infrastructure. So I wonder if you think that that's true, that these technologies will not be accessible to the world's poor, or if they will be.
Well, I don't know about Cuba, but but I'll say one thing. Because of concern over whether this would be available to emerging nations, should not be a reason to curb research which will eventually help all of us. You know, I'm of an age where I read Future Shock when I was in college, and I've seen these things sort of come to pass where things are just flying off the chart. We're living in the future now with such incredible advancements. How can we say right now that these technologies won't be used in ways to immediately export with vaccines against AIDS or anything else that might develop from these things?
Well, so, you just touched on my favorite example, which is the HIV antiretroviral therapies. I mean, you can't imagine a more expensive therapy for a more, in terms of global health, a more difficult nut to crack for third world developing countries. But yet you had this enormous first world public health campaign to increase the access for those drugs in the developing world because people were sympathetic with people with HIV. And yet the same people who would argue that people in Africa should have increased access to antiretrovirals will turn around and tell you that they shouldn't have access to things like stem cell research. It's kind of bizarre.
Well, it is. And I think, look, we have to accept the world that we live in right now and the real politics of it and the situation. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't advance this type of research as quickly as possible. No one has a real crystal ball, do we, as to what the future holds. But there are scientists now trying to work on a revolutionary new field. Do we curb it? Especially, do we curb it for ideological reasons, or do we support it? And when you look what happened in California, the people voted there. And I would submit to you, even the people in Mississippi or North Dakota or South Dakota or wherever there are restrictions on research, if they get the facts, you will find the tide shifting for this research advancing.
Bernie, I don't want to take you in a territory that you're not comfortable going in, but I presume that you come from a Jewish background. I come from a Unitarian background. Unitarians don't have very much of a theological problem with these issues. We tend to be pretty humanistically minded. And I just wonder if you've had any opportunity to reflect upon Judaism's thinking on these issues, the halakhic perspective, because it's been far more positive towards these technologies and reproductive technologies than the Christian conservative perspective has been.
Well, it's interesting you should say that. I don't know how you knew I was Jewish other than we shared a Chinese meal together the other day, but that's okay.
I just make an assumption on the basis of Siegel.
That's okay. I'm smiling when I say that. What occurs to me, well, in talking to rabbis and a very prominent bioethicist by the name of Lori Zoloth, who is at Northwestern. She also has taught Jewish studies. In the Jewish religion, the thought was the first 40 days of a pregnancy was like water. In other words, there was no moral or religious component to our concerns about the embryo. And when you take it out on a broader perspective, did the ancients know anything about in vitro fertilization? We live in a society that allows IUDs, it allows first-term abortion, it allows in vitro fertilization technologies, ART. So how can you want to restrict embryonic stem cell research when you have a society that allows all of these other things? It strikes me as being almost preposterous to want to do this, because this is the technology and this is the research that could actually cure people, perhaps, or alleviate mass suffering. And this is what you're going to stop? Makes no sense.
We only have time for about one or two more questions, and I just thought I wondered if you'd had any reflections about this conference we were just at and the issues of inheritable genetic modification, because many of the Luddites who want to draw a line at embryonic stem cell research argue that they need to draw the line there because it's going to lead to a radical transformation genetically and otherwise in the nature of humanity through more radical technologies like inheritable genetic modification. And I wonder if this is an area that your genetics policy institute is going to get into.
Well, it very well could be an area that we'll get into. Right now, we've been focused on stem cell research. But I think I need to address it in this way. We have to find cures for diseases to alleviate great suffering. And if the research is there, we should allow research to advance. As we approach danger zones or where there are great components of society that are opposed to this, or the dangers become apparent, then that's the time to try to draw societal boundaries or legal boundaries. At this point, I don't see where research should be impeded. And this is what this worries me, that the so-called bio-Luddites, they have an agenda where you take any emerging technology and you advance it out to its most extreme example and throw that example in the public policy debate and use fear, or bio-fear mongering, to restrain research. And this is what I think should be avoided at all costs. And the only way you do that is to educate the people about what the scientists are actually doing it, why they are doing it.
Well, I really want to thank you for joining us, and folks can find out more about the Genetics Policy Institute by going to Bernie's website at genpol.org. And is there anything else you want to direct them to, any publications or further work?
No, I would say go to the website. We'd be glad to respond to you, any inquiries that you have.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Bernie.
Jay, thank you. Bye.
Some of the other organizations, in addition to the Genetics Policy Institute, that you may be interested in checking out, if you're interested in the politics of embryonic stem cell research, are the Coalition for the Advancement of Medical Research, or CAMR, C-A-M-R, which is at CAMRAdvocacy.org, CAMRAdvocacy.org. And that's a coalition of national patients organizations, universities, scientific societies, foundations, and individuals. The Christopher Reeves organization is a part of this coalition. And they have been one of the principal lobbies trying to defend embryonic stem cell research both nationally and to some degree internationally. They worked with Bernie on lobbying the UN to defeat the Bush administration's attempt to have an international treaty banning embryonic stem cell research. One of the left-wing bio-Luddite groups that we mentioned that has been active in lobbying against embryonic stem cell research, although their formal position is that they're in favor of stem cell research, but they're just opposed to all the existing laws and efforts to promote it, is the Center for Genetics and Society. And they're at genetics-and-society.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.